Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of September. We've been doing a series of programs as we approach the presidential election on where the presidential candidates stand on major issues. Today, we're going to be looking at science. John McCain and Barack Obama have answered questions, 14 questions on science and technology. And this got started almost 2 years ago. In November of 2007, a small group of people, six citizens, two screenwriters, a physicist, a biologist, a philosopher, and a science journalist began working to restore science innovation to America's political dialogue. They called themselves Science Debate 2008, and they also asked for a presidential debate on science. Well, within weeks, more than 38,000 scientists, engineers, and concerned Americans signed on, including every major American science organization, many Nobel laureates, elected officials, business leaders, and the presidents of over 100 American universities. What has happened is that both Senator John McCain and Senator Barack Obama have provided answers to 14 questions on science and technology. And we'll talk about what our guest says are America's major unsolved challenges revolving around these 14 questions. Our guest this hour is Science Debate 2008's Chief Executive Officer, Minnesota's screenwriter, Sharon Lawrence Otto. And our phone number, as always, as you talk about science and the presidency, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Sean, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this really took off, didn't it?
It sure did. You know, it was something that the six of us were talking about, and Matthew Chapman, actually, who's the other screenwriter involved in getting this going, called me up, and he'd been noticing that none of the primary debates had even mentioned science issues at that point, and we'd had several already by then, if you can believe it or not. It's been a long election.
Oh, yeah.
But we started talking about that and how science has really been eroded in our public discourse, and we decided we needed to do something about it.
And you have said that most of America's major unsolved challenges revolve around these 14 scientific questions. As you look through the questions, they're very important. How do our major unsolved challenges revolve around them?
Well, you know, our lives are dominated more and more by science and technology. They really have changed everything about every part of our lives. And so it makes sense that they would change our public policy and our approaches to public policy, which is about how we govern ourselves in our lives. So a lot of these questions, more and more that elected officials are facing, focus on science and technology issues. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Innovation is one of the big questions that people in the science and technology community are talking about. Science and technology have been responsible for half of the economic growth of the United States since World War II. Nothing else even comes close. But now, by 2010, several reports suggest that 90% of all scientists and engineers will be living in Asia.
Hmm.
And that is a huge fundamental change in the global economics that once advantaged the United States. And if we don't wake up to that and begin reinvesting our energy and our attention in this, we're going to become a second-rate economic power.
Did you say 90%?
90%. It's shocking. When you look at it on an annual basis, Asian countries are graduating over 600,000 scientists and engineers every year. The United States is graduating about 70,000, and many of those are foreign students who are now not staying in the United States. Often they're going back to their countries because we have also a pipeline problem here where many of our graduates in science and technology can't get grants and therefore can't get research jobs to support a career. So fewer and fewer people are electing to go into that.
And can you tell me why? Is it partially not being able to get money for research, but is there something else that we're downplaying the importance of science and math in elementary school, in middle school, in high school?
Yeah, well, that is a big, big part of the problem, and that's the, one of our questions, too, is education, especially starting early. You know, there's been a comparison recently of 15-year-olds in the 30 wealthiest nations found that average science scores among U.S. students rank 17th, and average U.S. math scores rank 24th. So, you know, a few years ago, we were third. So we're really slipping. And that is, you know, there's a lot of conversation about exactly why that might be. Some of it is obviously a tone that has to be set by the president and has to filter on down through the culture. But some of it is also focused on how long our school year is, what our standards are, how rigorous our approach is, whether or not we're using technology in the classroom or whether we're still, you know, stuck in modes of teaching that were appropriate maybe 30 years ago but are no longer in a technology-dominated world.
You had people from all over the country, scientists, leaders of universities, average citizens, send you questions. You had 3,400 questions, which is a lot of questions. And
yeah.
You came up then with 14 that you thought the presidential candidates should answer. Wasn't that an amazing number of questions?
Oh, it was overwhelming. The passion that this tapped in the science and academic and innovation and technology and business community was just really surprising to us. And everybody had a question, it seemed like. So what we did is we began to categorize them, and many of them fell into general categories. And once we realized that, then we began to look for the most representative questions. And to hone those, we worked together with the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the National Academies of Science and Engineering, the Institute of Medicine and Scientists and Engineers for America, and the Council on Competitiveness, which represents business, universities, and labor groups. And we focused them on the 14 top questions that people most commonly were concerned about.
And then you sent them on to the presidential candidates, and they responded to each of them?
Yes, they did. It took quite a bit of prodding to get them to respond.
Did it?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. Well, you know, from their perspective, they thought this is kind of a niche topic maybe, and talking about these things is going to require an awful lot of prep work for maybe very limited return, and nobody wanted to repeat the famous Dan Quayle mistake of saying that trees produce smog. So there is some risk that's associated with this from a politician's point of view. But we worked to counter that by doing some national polling then. And our national polling showed that 85% of Americans would be interested in and probably tune into a presidential debate that was devoted to these things. And 72% of Americans would be more likely to vote for a candidate that had some real solutions to these things. So we're talking about big, broad swaths of the American electorate here. People do care about this. And we've been working to re-educate the campaigns and the media about how America needs to start talking about science and technology again.
Well, when you look at the issues, we're looking at the future of the planet, right? We're looking at climate change, energy, air and water, renewable energy, research. There aren't too many issues that are more important than that.
No, absolutely. And here we are talking about lipstick on pigs. And,
right.
You know, flag lapel pins and all that kind of silly stuff that we get into. And we think that, you know, we're smart enough in America. We're a country that has led the world with our smarts and with our ingenuity and our innovation. And we were founded by scientist statesmen like Jefferson and Franklin. So we ought to be talking about these things when we elect a president.
Right. So you didn't get a presidential debate out of this. You did get answers on these 14 questions. And were you successful in being able to have some of these questions make their way to one of the three presidential debates?
Well, we're hoping that that's going to be the case. We've been working with some of the debate moderators and some of the hosts, and we'll just have to see.
What is the major scientific question of our time, Sean?
Well, really, there are two of them that I frequently talk about, you know, and I'll use Sputnik as an example because it's really apropos. When the Soviet Union shot Sputnik up in 1957, that really was a wake-up call to the United States, and that influenced the 1960 election even, and Kennedy made a huge commitment to the space program, and that really propelled American science for the next generation. Ronald Reagan, again, in competition with the Soviet Union, came up with the idea of Star Wars, and that defense spending, even though it in some ways was a debacle, it still pushed a lot of science and technology development through. Nowadays, we don't have an opponent that is competing with us in a direct sense like the Soviet Union was. So some of the focus has shifted, and unfortunately it seems like the U.S. may need that. But what I say is these days we have two Sputniks out there. They're not floating around in space, but they're every bit as threatening. And the first is the rise of Asian economies and their huge, huge investments in science and technology, which are dwarfing ours. And that is the future of the economy of the planet. The other one is climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, as much as certain people think that it's a partisan issue, it really is a fact-based issue. Even the National Academy of Sciences has come out with a very definitive report that says that climate change is real and it is human-caused, and we need to grapple with this. And this is a very, very conservative organization. They were chartered by President Lincoln in the 1860s. So when they come out with something, they are careful to make certain that they back it up. So we're very happy that both presidential candidates realize that this is a real issue and that humans are a major factor in it. And they both do have some fairly clear plans of how they're going to approach it.
And the plans presented by McCain and Obama are radically different, or are they somewhat similar?
Well, they're both similar and radically different. where they're similar is that they both acknowledge that it is a human caused problem and that it is real, and that we do have to grapple with it. Where they differ is in their approaches on how to do that. There's something called the IPCC4, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a group of scientists from dozens of nations around the world, and many of them in the United States, that did exhaustive studies on this and came out with some recommendations. And the real recommendation, to boil it down to a nutshell, is that we should reduce our carbon emissions to a level that's 80% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. So that's way below where we are now. How do we get there is the question. And Obama and McCain have different approaches to that. First of all, let me just say that Obama's goal or target is at that 80% level. McCain's goal is only 60% reduction, not 80% reduction below 1990 levels. So how do they get there? McCain says that he'd like to build 45 new nuclear plants, and Obama says that he is not averse to nuclear, although he wants to make certain that we deal with some of the safety and waste issues. His focus is more on renewables and also on clean coal technology with carbon sequestering. Both of them are talking about investment in research in renewable energy. Both of them are talking about offshore drilling, although McCain is, as we all know from the rest of his campaign statements, is pushing that a little bit harder.
Right. And let's look at the other issue about all of the people in China and India particularly, who are studying science and technology. What is the response to that? If we are, as you said earlier, half of the economic growth is due to science and technology in the last century, what kind of science and technology development are we looking at, and how would they respond to getting a number of students needed to go on to higher education in these areas to advance science and technology, to come up with new innovations?
Yeah. Well, Obama is talking about doubling the general research budgets of our major science foundations over a 10-year time frame. Those are the National Science Foundation, principally, and the National Institutes of Health. By doing that, what he hopes to do is to essentially bring down the age that that PhDs can get grants to begin to do research. Right now, the average age for both those institutions is around 40 years old.
Hmm.
That's pretty tough, especially when most major discoveries are made by people in their late 20s and early 30s. So asking them to wait that long is really essentially pushing them out of a career in science. So there's a pipeline issue that he hopes to solve that way. McCain is looking, you know, he talks about more emphasis on business, and he mentions how his policies will provide broad pools of capital and low taxes and incentives for research in America. So essentially he's talking about promoting business investment in R&D, which is viable, but that is not basic research, which is where we need to focus our efforts, according to many of the scientists that are signed on to this initiative. We need to talk about, you know, blue sky, about investing in research where we don't really necessarily know what the outcome is. Corporate R&D usually is within a 2 to 3 year time frame, and it's geared towards something that can be brought to market in that time frame. So it's not basic research, it's called applied research. And there's a big difference. I'll give you an example of basic research and the kind of effects that it can have. Here in Minnesota, which is where I am currently, I am really aware of a guy named E.W. Davis, who worked for the University of Minnesota for many years. And, you know, they funded him, I think, over, maybe 30 years. And his lab, at let's say what was an astronomical sum for that time of $100,000 a year. So over that time period, they probably put, you know, $300,000 into funding him and his lab in the 30s and 40s. All blue sky, what are they going to get out of it? He had this goofy idea of looking at this waste rock, this rubble up on the North Shore called taconite, and seeing if there is something that could be done with it. And he found a way to extract iron out of taconite, and the whole North economy of Minnesota has been powered by that for decades. We're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars, and to this year, I think it's something like 60% of all the steel used in U.S.-made cars and ships and bridges comes from the Mesabi Range in northeastern Minnesota. So these kind of investments in basic research pay off big time. We don't always know where they're going to come from, but we know that if we don't do them, we don't reap the rewards.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Sean, and we'll take them in a moment. Our guest is the organizer of the Science Debate 2008. And what an interesting, it's amazing when people who have creative minds get together, what can happen as a result of this. This got started almost 2 years ago when some screenwriters, a physicist, a biologist, a philosopher, and a science journalist sat around and started talking about how we needed to restore science into the presidential debate. They called themselves Science Debate 2008 and called for a presidential debate on science. As you heard Sean say, they're working now with the moderators of the three presidential debates to try to get some of these 14 questions included in the debates. And they have been able to get responses to 14 major questions culled from 3,400 questions that were sent by all kinds of people, heads of universities, Nobel laureates, elected officials, every major science organization. They found 14 that were common kinds of questions, and both presidential candidates have responded to those questions. We can talk more about the answers and welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, it's our September open line. So if you have great suggestions for shows you'd like to hear from 9 until 11, please call. We welcome your phone calls once a month, and we take your suggestions seriously. Let's go to phone calls now for Sean Lawrence Otto, who is organizer of the Science Debate 2008. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Dick from Waukesha is our first caller. Sean, hi, Dick.
Hi, Kathleen. A question and a suggestion for your guest. I wonder if he is familiar with the book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, by James Gustav Speth, S-P-E-T-H. He should be, because Speth is the dean of forestry and the environment at Yale University, and his whole book is about how to get right with the world, as it were, quit ruining it. And he's got to know. It comes highly recommended by a lot of well-known people. So the Bridge at the Edge of the World by James Gustav Speth, S-P-E-T-H.
And he would be a good guest for a talk show, right, Dick?
Actually, he was on some months ago.
Oh, was he?
I've forgotten whose program. Mm-hmm. Not yours, probably.
No.
Might have been Joyce, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Thanks, Dick, for the call. Does he have a lot of the answers, Sean?
Oh, you know what? I haven't read the book.
Okay.
I've heard a lot of people speak very highly of it, though. And I think that what the caller was talking about is a really important motivator for many of us in this discussion. You know, I'm in this for my son, because I'm concerned about the future of the planet that we're going to be leaving behind for him and the future of the economic health of the country. One thing that Matthew and I talk about a lot, this is Matthew Chapman, the other screenwriter involved in this, who happens to be Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson, by the way.
Oh.
This is about the health of the planet, the health of our economy, and the health of our families. And that really motivates me. You know, when I was a kid, anytime there was a moonshot, we'd cancel the classes, everybody
right.
Come sit in the auditorium and watch that rocket go up on TV. And that's how much this nation valued science. And we can get back there. We owe it to ourselves to respect ourselves, to respect our intelligence, and to realize that these are challenges that Americans have always risen to and that we can tackle them.
How did the candidates respond to the future of space?
You know, that's a very interesting question. They had very different responses. The question... I'll tell you what the question was. It was, the study of Earth from space can yield important information about climate change. Focus on the cosmos can advance our understanding of the universe. And manned space travel can help us inspire new generations of youth to go into science. Can we afford all of them? How would you prioritize space in your administration? And that is a big, big, big debate going on right now in the space community. Because manned space travel is so expensive, and can we afford that, or should we be sending robots, and will we get as much information back? And there are strong, strong arguments on both sides of that. There are some things that robots just can't do. On the other hand, can we afford the kind of investment at this point in time to send manned space missions, for instance, to Mars? Others will say, you know, can we afford not to? We need that to galvanize the imagination of the next generation, and we need it for the information on space travel that it's going to provide us. John McCain has much more detailed answers to the space question than Barack Obama does. Although Obama's, though shorter, are very specific in his focus. So I invite people to go to the site and assess them for themselves and decide which candidate has a stronger commitment there.
Right. And tell us the site.
The site is www.sciencedebate2008.com. And we also have a facility there, if you get there, that you can click on it and vote on your responses to the candidates' answers. You can grade them A through F on how well they did on each of them and provide comments on why you gave them that grade. We really wanted to open this discussion up to the public.
Great, so we get to grade them.
Yep.
That's fun.
Who doesn't love that?
Right.
Everybody will remember back to science class and that C that they got that they didn't deserve.
Right. Thanks, Dick, very much for your call. Let's go to Jeff from Dubuque next. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Diane. A couple things. I spent 25 years in higher education, and there were two things that I found missing, and I think that these might be helpful to the advancement of science. One is the lack of education on creative thinking. Nobody was taught, the academic process is critical thinking rather than the creative thinking process. So I thought any kind of introductory courses on creative thinking might help not only folks in science, but also across the disciplines. The second thing I found missing was any kind of central department that would serve as a thinkubator, a spot where folks can come in from a multidisciplinary perspective and harness the academic brain power or the collective academic brain power to come up with some new innovations, not only in science but in medicine, that would give us some payback on higher education. And I was interested in your thoughts on that, as, from your perspective, whether you thought that there was a value in teaching creative thinking and whether you thought there might be a value in having some kind of central department that would enable us to collectively, work on projects together from across the disciplines. Thank you.
Great questions. Sean?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I think that both of those questions are very important. Obviously, they're not questions that we were going to ask in the 14 top ones because we only have room for one question on education, and so we need to phrase that as broadly as we can to allow for a wide variety of possible answers and yet specifically enough to focus the discussion. But I think that as far as solutions go, those are very, very, very important parts of the equation. We wouldn't have done what we did if we didn't have a cross-disciplinary coalition put together here. It really took people from a wide variety of backgrounds to accomplish what we've done. And we're seeing that more and more in science. Science for 40 years really focused on specialization, and there are more and more disciplines now that are drawing from a variety of fields because we're realizing that that narrow of a focus really doesn't give you a full picture if you're going to effectively understand how these complex systems work. So I think both of those are extremely valid, and I think that that's the future of education in the United States.
You have to have the question, what would happen if, in order to explore the world of science and to come up with innovation, don't you think?
Oh, right. Well, and that's the big question in any kind of creative endeavor. I work in Hollywood as a writer, and the question that you ask in coming up with a movie is, what if?
Right.
And you have to be able to do that. And that is a skill and a talent, and let's call it a muscle in your, in your brain that you have to strengthen. And without kids being given that opportunity and pushed to do that, sometimes they don't even realize that creativity is a fundamental part of living your life and moving forward.
I believe it was Senator McCain, maybe Senator Obama, maybe both of them, and I don't know if this is meaningful or not, said that they would put some kind of science guru very close in the administration to the presidency. There'd be a special department for science and technology. Am I right about that?
Yes. They both talked about that. Senator McCain talked more about having a cabinet-level science advisor. Senator Obama talked about the nation's first chief technology officer. Both of them have talked about the problem right now in science in the Bush administration. President Bush does have a science advisor, John Marburger, but he's not a cabinet-level science advisor, and he really is has not been obviously very well consulted by the administration or regarded by the administration. With science being so central to so many of the issues that are festering in our country and around the world, we really need somebody that will be a bridge of communication between the science community and the president.
Mark from Green Bay is next. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the guest's reflection on a certain anti-intellectualism that sometimes comes across in American culture. You know, people say, let's not trust this policy to the people with the test tubes, or even something as simple as these rather frequent debates about evolution and about how even on Sunday morning from pulpits oftentimes discrediting legitimate science in biology.
Well, that's a big issue these days in American pop culture, and a lot of that tone is set by the president and what the president values. As far as the anti-intellectualism, that's very real right now. It wasn't always that way. Again, in the 60s, for instance, and 70s, we were not anti-intellectual by any means. Part of that was our competition with the Soviet Union over science, and it was cool to be innovative and be smart. And we need to get back there. These days you see kids who are talking about how they don't know math. Well, and that's okay, apparently. But, you know, that's like saying, you know, I don't know how to talk. I don't know how to brush my teeth. I don't know how to take care of myself. We've got to get to a point where not knowing math is just totally unacceptable in the United States in the modern world. The creationism and evolution debate is a really interesting one, and we talked about that. We didn't include a question on it because it's really a state-level debate, and it's something that the president has indirect influence over but doesn't have any direct policy involvement in. But many, 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 many of our supporters think that that's really the number one question in America right now, because if our students aren't educated on evolution, they're not going to be able to innovate in biology or health. And most people don't realize that all of modern biology and medicine is based on the theory of evolution. The theory of evolution is as strong as the theory of gravity. Creationism is a religious belief, but it is not a theory with any weight or merit that has comparable value to evolution in our ability to solve problems, keep ourselves healthy, find solutions or cures to diseases, attack microorganisms, keep ourselves clean in our homes and in our bodies.
And my understanding is that the current president and the presidential candidates have different views on this issue, that President Bush has said that he believes that intelligent design ought to be taught in the classroom, that Sarah Palin has said the same, that John McCain and Barack Obama are believers in evolution. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct, although McCain has been nuancing his statements a little bit more recently, especially after the selection of his running mate. And I think that we're probably seeing evidence of some political consultants there looking at the base and focusing on how do we motivate evangelical fundamentalist voters again, because they were such a powerful, powerful voting bloc. But I think that part of that base is shifting. There is a large movement in the evangelical community focusing on stewardship, especially around the climate change issue. And many people are beginning to feel like their beliefs have been used to leverage their community in ways that they're not necessarily entirely pleased with. So there is some reevaluation going on. One of the members of our steering committee is actually a gentleman named Calvin DeWitt, who is the president of the American Association of Evangelical Scientists and Ethicists.
More phone calls in a moment. Sean Lawrence Otto is our guest, organizer of Science Debate 2008. A couple years ago, a small group of citizens, screenwriters, Sean among them, a physicist, a biologist, a philosopher, and a science journalist, talked about the fact that we need to restore science to a level of presidential debate. Then they passed the word, and oh my gosh, did a lot of people agree with them. 38,000 scientists, engineers, and other concerned Americans signed on, and they came up with 3,400 questions that they want the candidates for president to answer about the science future of America. They cleaned them down to 14 questions, and the presidential candidate, Senator Barack Obama and Senator John McCain, have answered those, and we are talking about their answers in the future of science, innovation, technology in this country, and welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800. Thanks, Mark, for your call. One line is open, 800-486-8655. Or if you'd like to send an email, we don't have any of those today. That's talk@WPR.org. We'd be happy to entertain a couple of those along the way. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program, we go to you for suggestions for programs from 9 to 11. We take them seriously. We know you give your suggestions a lot of thought, and we will open the phone lines for our September open line, the second hour of today's show. Sean Lawrence Otto is our guest now, organizer of Science Debate 2008. We are flooded with phone calls this hour, which is great. It's wonderful to know that you have great concern about these huge topics of our time. And Rob from Wausau is our next caller, Sean. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Just a quick question about what questions were put forth regarding stem cell research and the advancement of that research in this country, and what were some of the answers for the candidates? And I'll take the answer off there. Thank you.
Okay, great question. Yeah. We did ask the candidates, and you can go to our site again at www.sciencedebate2008.com, and you can look at all the questions and actually grade the candidates on their answers. But question number 8 that we asked them was, stem cell research advocates say that it may successfully lead to treatments for many chronic diseases and injuries, saving lives, but opponents argue that using embryos as a source for stem cells destroys human life. What is your position on government regulation and funding of stem cell research? And the answers are actually markedly different here. Senator Obama talks a great deal about the need to fund human embryonic stem cell research to end the restrictions that President Bush has placed on that funding. Senator McCain says that while he supports federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, he believes that clear lines should be drawn that reflect a refusal to sacrifice moral values and ethical principles for the sake of scientific progress. So, and he also conflates fetuses with embryos and talks about fetal farming, which many writers and commentators have since expressed concern about, because there's no such thing as fetal farming. The embryos in question really are 8-day-old or less small groups of cells that have been created through in vitro fertilization and are left over. These are parents that have not used these cells. They've achieved pregnancy, and these cells are going to be discarded. They are frozen right now, and they are not at the stage where they could be considered a fetus yet. They're not defined that way. So the question is, what do we do with them? They are a source of stem cells for research purposes, or should we discard them, or should they remain frozen indefinitely? And it's a big, big moral and ethical question because, James Thompson, who's one of our supporters, has discovered a way to create stem cells from adult skin cells. This he announced last year, and I think he's in your home city there, Madison. But there's significant question about whether or not those sources will be viable for treating the wide variety of injuries and diseases that embryonic stem cells can treat.
And thanks for the call. What did both candidates have to say about pandemics and biosecurity, Sean?
Well, we asked a question that was a two-pronged question. You know, there was a lot of talk a couple of years ago about avian flu.
There sure was.
Yeah.
And scared the heck out of us.
Yeah. And a lot of, and there's still, by the way, reason to be concerned even now. But a lot of local governments, especially, everybody had to come out with their pandemic awareness plan and their response plan to how they would handle this. And people were talking about how it could kill more than 300 million people and what to do. The other side of that question is what if something like that were used as a deliberate biological attack? How do we deal with that, especially in a world where there's rapid international travel? I know some science fiction writers have written about this, putting, you know, various bioagents in aerosol cans and leaving them all over the place. There's a lot of different potential nightmare scenarios. How do we approach it? And the candidates had somewhat different approaches to that, too. Although both of them acknowledge that it's an issue that the United States really needs to deal with, and they both focused on the need to accelerate our technology for detecting these kinds of problems, especially with a biological attack, and tracing it back to its source so it can be contained as quickly as possible. McCain was talking about essentially quarantining certain areas of the country that might be affected and trying to shut down travel and contain the disease that way. And Obama was talking more about preventative investment in research and less on what to do after an attack occurred or after a pandemic broke out.
We go back to phone calls, and we have some lines open. A lot of you hung up. I'm sorry, but here's the number, 800-486-8655, and we should be able to get to many more phone calls. So reactivate your call, and we'll be with you in a moment. Steve from Wauwatosa is next. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to preface what I'm going to say. I love science, and I'm very fascinated by it. I love discussing it. I love reading about it. But something I haven't heard the guests talk about to this point are actually the problems that science causes. And I was kind of concerned that when he prefaced his first remarks today, he kind of gave a lot of, he said it was very important because of the 90% economic growth that was caused by science or that science contributed to. And to me, that's actually a number that gives me more concern than satisfaction because my concern is if you look at the major global problems we have, which include global warming, which we talked about, which you talked about, also includes nuclear threats. You just mentioned disease or bioterrorism, that kind of thing. Also things like loss of biodiversity in the world. If you look at these major global threats, it seems hard to avoid the understanding that they actually have been caused by a combination of population growth, economic growth, and technology. So technology and 90% economic growth actually causes a lot of major troubling problems. And so to me, one of the major issues about talking about science is to say, how do we fit it within a culture where, yes, knowledge and technology can be very useful, but how do we put it into a context of a culture that's wise enough to know when to restrain itself and how to use things with moderation?
That's a great question. Sean?
Yeah, it is a great question. And science is a tool, and like any tool, it can be used to cut in more than one direction. And what we're talking about is using science to solve a lot of the challenges. Certainly a lot of the challenges have been created by science, but we can't throw up our hands and say, well, we can't use it to solve them. The Industrial Revolution, of course, was created by science and technology. And I think that the attitudes are shifting. We used to have an attitude that the Earth was limitless. It was so large, and people were so small, we couldn't have really that much of an impact on it. But science has helped us become more and more aware of how much of an impact we are having. And as our knowledge of our impact has grown, so is our understanding of our need to moderate our behavior. The whole climate change discussion is a great example of that.
Are you going to be asking and distributing, or maybe you already have, these questions to the vice presidential candidates?
We've had a lot of discussion about that. We haven't decided yet whether that's something that we're going to do, but a number of people are very interested in that, particularly over the climate change and the creationism questions, because
yes.
Governor Palin has expressed some fairly clear opinions on those.
Thank you, Steve, very much for your interesting call. Rich from Prairie Farm is next. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Pretty good.
Good.
Just a ton of questions, really, but just one, I guess. What it seems like in the school system, you know, one reason we have trouble with kids and sciences maybe is because learning about the human experience and how it's not really part of the natural sciences, or the dissociation of the human experience from natural sciences. And I'm just wondering what your views are on something like that.
Gee, I'm not sure I understand.
I'm not sure I do either. Can you?
Well, kids learn about culture and history and all of that, but not really how we've, you know, like, come to this country and learn all the things about how we had to learn about what it took to survive here. And it's like, you know, that's not really a part of what kids learn about anymore. And science being, you know, the essence of natural sciences and all that kind of stuff. And maybe I'm still not making any sense, but it just seems like kids don't learn about our place in the world, in the natural world, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I think that more science teachers are really focusing on the natural cycle and on environmental balance. And how people do fit in, both environmentally and in terms of our interaction with other organisms. And I think that a lot of science is moving more and more in that direction. As I said in response to another earlier caller, we're becoming a little bit less specialized and realizing that there's room for generalists and for cross-disciplinary work as well. So I think that's a good point, and we do need to focus on making it hands-on so students understand that it really has an impact in their day-to-day life.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Fern from Gilbert, Minnesota. Hi, Fern.
I was interested in the speaker's reference to Dr. Davis. We're faced with a different type of mining in northern Minnesota now, sulfide mining. And it's especially dangerous because of our high water table and abundance of wetlands. There would be acid mine drainage and production of methyl mercury and inhalable particulates and so on. So we're more or less saying, why not mine in dry areas? And it certainly would be more cost effective to mine ores that have a higher mineral content than they do in northern Minnesota. So it's an area where the attraction is jobs, and the lead company, PolyMet, a Vancouver-based company, is coming out with reams of documents, which more or less are pseudoscience. So how do you educate students, for instance, to distinguish between real science and pseudoscience, or sound science and pseudoscience?
Good question. We have about 30 seconds, Sean.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a really good question. Generally, if something is corporate funded, they've got a perspective. And I think that science teachers do focus on that. My wife was a science teacher, and she used to work a lot with critical thinking, getting kids to really examine the difference and question how maybe they're being manipulated. But it's a big, big issue.
And thank you so much, Sean. What a wonderfully creative idea that you've set in motion here. It's so important, and it's amazing what a group of concerned citizens can do. Right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's been a pleasure being on, and if anybody takes anything away from this, just remember, I'm not a scientist. I'm just an ordinary citizen, and I'm just concerned about the future, and all of us as Americans should be engaged on these issues.
Right. And if you want to get all the complete answers, we couldn't do all of them. It's a very long 14 questions, lots of pages, 14 pages from both of the candidates. Go to ScienceDebate2008.com, ScienceDebate2008.com to get the full explanations. Thanks to Sean Lawrence Otto, organizer of Science Debate 2008, and Rhonda Fanning for producing and doing on-air production here on the Ideas Network.